From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Donald Trump campaigned on getting rid of environmental regulations he says tie business down. Restrictions on oil drilling, coal burning, and fracking. Having tweeted that global warming is a Chinese hoax, candidate Trump said he would reduce the Environmental Protection Agency to, quote, tidbits, close quote, and would pull out of the International Paris Agreement to cut greenhouse emissions. Today we'll talk to two University of Maryland experts about what they expect worldwide and in Maryland, including Chesapeake Bay. Both worry about the fallout if the U.S. refuses to take part in the international effort to slow global warming.
We'll be a pariah. We'll be a pariah in the global stage on almost everything if we stay out of this.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Donald Trump campaigned on promises to make it easier to drill for oil and burn coal. He pledged to leave only, quote, tidbits, close quote, of the Environmental Protection Agency in place and to pull the U.S. out of international climate treaties. Here's part of the energy policy he laid out last May.
We're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement and stop. Unbelievable. And stop all payments of the United States tax dollars to UN global warming programs.
Today we'll hear from two University of Maryland experts. In a few minutes, we'll speak with Donald Bosch, president of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. First, Robert Orr heads the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland College Park. He's also senior advisor to the United Nations on climate change. We spoke late last week before Orr headed to Marrakesh, Morocco, for the talks about how to implement the Paris Climate Agreement. The countries that signed on to the Paris Climate Accord are meeting in Marrakesh, Morocco, a meeting that was scheduled a long time ago. How does the election of Donald Trump change the agenda there? Or does it?
There is, of course, great concern around the world that the stated positions during the campaign could become U.S. policy. There was a full global agreement with all the countries of the world agreeing in Paris to limit temperature rise to well below 2 degrees Celsius. That is something that has yet to take place, and I think countries are already talking with each other about how to proceed, if in fact they have to, without the United States.
Donald Trump campaigned on a promise to, quote, cancel the Paris Climate Agreement. He characterized it as giving, quote, foreign bureaucrats control over how much energy we use, close quote. How do you describe the restraints in the Paris Accord, and does the president have the power to cancel it?
No, in fact, the president does not. It shows a fundamental misunderstanding both of the agreement and of the U.S.'s ability to dictate to other countries on this issue. First, what the U.S. can do is it could pursue a withdrawal from the Paris Agreement. That itself would take 3 years. But, of course, other countries are preparing to move ahead with or without the United States. Everyone sees that global warming and climate change is affecting their economies and their people, and they aren't ready to be dictated to by the United States, whatever it does. China has been very clear that it is pursuing its policies on climate change because they are in their interests, not because the U.S. asked them to.
And of course, much was made during the campaign of a tweet that Donald Trump put out 4 years ago where he pointed to the Chinese as creators of what he said was basically a hoax. Quote, the concept of global warming was created by and for the Chinese in order to make U.S. manufacturing non-competitive, close quote. When Hillary Clinton raised that in a debate, Donald Trump denied that he had ever said it. So does that give you some hope that he's not truly committed to acting on it?
The idea that climate change is a hoax is, of course, an old canard that comes from a segment of the political spectrum that Donald Trump does not easily fit with. So we are going to see here if he is the pragmatic businessman that he has said he is, or if he is going to side with ideologues on a question that is of direct importance to the U.S. economy. And I think the basic question is, as president, does he want a vibrant economy with tomorrow's industries healthy and in America, or does he want to try to hold back the tide and back losing industries that cannot maintain jobs and certainly cannot create wealth for American workers or owners?
Andrew Revkin, the environmental writer in the New York Times, wrote the day after the election, quote, "The bad news about climate change is in a way the good news," close quote, and went on to write about market forces. Talk about that.
Of course, this is the fundamental reality on addressing climate change, that this is no longer the purview just of governments. In fact, the biggest moves in combating climate change and in causing climate change are coming from the marketplace. Therefore, when we talk about combating climate change, it is more about what the companies are going to do and investors are going to do than it is about what governments will do. That said, it does matter what a government's policies are. So while Mr. Trump cannot dictate to markets what will happen, and he can't dictate that the price of coal will be other than what it is, the fact is that markets are going to keep the momentum moving forward on climate change because the price of renewables and of gas are going down and the prices of coal are going up. And that will only increase as the technologies continue to squeeze inefficiencies out of the economy.
That's Bob Orr. He is special advisor to the Secretary General of the United Nations on climate change. He is in Marrakesh, Morocco, at a climate change meeting. He's also head of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, College Park. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. The Trump team put Myron Ebell, the longtime director of energy and environment policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, in charge of the transition team looking at the Environmental Protection Agency. What message does that send to you?
Clearly, the message is that the president-elect wants a sharp change in course. We need to wait and see what all the appointments are, but it's not an encouraging sign that someone who has denied facts about climate change and seems to be proud of the fact that he denies facts on climate change, that is of some concern. But I think we do need to see who else the president puts into not just the environmental field, but the economic field. I think you could see a lot of tension between anyone he appoints that is in charge of trying to move the economy forward and growing jobs, if there is, in fact, a wing of his administration that is trying to prop up inefficient and old yesterday's industries against tomorrow's industries. So there may be a little civil war in the offing here between economic pragmatists and environmental ideologues.
Well, tell me more about that, because certainly there was a theme in Donald Trump's campaign speeches of getting rid of government regulation, all kinds of government regulation, as a way of bringing jobs back or creating more jobs.
Of course, the biggest intervention into a free market that affects climate change is, in fact, the massive fossil fuel subsidies that the government provides. If, in fact, he is for deregulation, the first thing that he should be doing is taking out these extremely inefficient, unproductive fossil fuel subsidies. Of course, that may not be what he means. He may be focused only on one side of regulation, and that is that would protect the environment. And I think here we do need to remember that there are laws in place that I would find it surprising if he is able to change, things like the Clean Air Act. This has strong bipartisan support, and if he tries to undo something like the Clean Air Act, I think he will find it harder than he expects.
How does all of that connect to the Paris Climate Agreement?
The Paris Climate Agreement embodies a global understanding that this is a threat for every government, for every economy, for every citizen around the globe. It is also reflects an agreement that we need to work together to address it. If the United States steps out of that global consensus and tries to go it alone, I think the marketplace will punish the U.S. So I think the question is how much pain is a potential Trump administration willing to endure simply to satisfy a few ideologues in one part of the party.
So you're traveling to Marrakesh. You'll be talking to the representatives of the countries that are part of the Paris Accord and to other environmentalists who are there. What do you intend to say?
I think the first step is we all have to take a deep breath and see what the new administration in fact does. There is often a pretty strong dichotomy between campaign rhetoric and governing. But then I think on the international level, governments are talking about how they proceed to move this agenda forward regardless of what the U.S. does. And I think that shows a realism about their interests and a realism about the forces that will either enhance or detract from the anti-climate change effort.
Thanks for talking to us about it. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Robert Orr is Dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland College Park and Special Advisor to the Secretary General of the United Nations on climate change. We spoke late last week before he traveled to Marrakesh, Morocco. Quick break now on the record. When we're back, we'll continue our discussion of how President Trump's environmental policies might look with the President of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about how Donald Trump campaigned on environmental issues and how those campaign positions may play out in a Trump presidency. Speaking to reporters this week, President Obama sounded optimistic that his successor would maintain efforts to protect the environment, such as reducing greenhouse emissions.
The good news is that what we've been able to show over the last 5, 6, 8 years is that it's possible to grow the economy really fast and possible to bring down carbon emissions as well. It's not just a bunch of rules that we've set up. You've got utilities that are putting in solar panels and creating jobs. You've got the big three automakers who have seen record sales and are overachieving on the fuel efficiency standards that we set. Turns out that people like not having to fill up as often and save money at the pump, even if it's good for the environment.
What changes will President-elect Trump make in U.S. climate policy? What's ahead for U.S. positions on global warming, for cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay? With me in studio now is Donald Bosch, president of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. Welcome to On the Record.
It's good to be with you again, Sheila.
Do you share President Obama's hopefulness, or are you more in the mode of Time magazine, which headlined its story about climate change, quote, Donald Trump's victory could mean disaster for the planet, close quote?
Well, I don't think we have much choice but to wait and see, you know, whether we have someone, a president, who comes out and tries to execute sort of the rogue candidate exaggerated commitments that he made, or whether he's going to be a thoughtful president for all Americans. And, you know, he's made some shifts already with respect to his position, for example, on the Affordable Care Act. So I think we just have to give him some time and keep pressure on.
What are you going to be watching for in particular?
Well, I think one of the first things you see happen is appointments. So appointments are very critical. We need in our country leaders of all of our agencies who have experience, who have a broad, sober perspective about where we are, not only in the country, but in the world. So there may be some more, you know, conservative market-based approaches to some of the environmental issues. But if he appoints someone who is just a, you know, climate change denier and wants to turn back all environmental rules just on principle to head EPA, then we've got problems, for example.
You have been very involved in the efforts to clean up the Chesapeake Bay. First of all, catch us up briefly on where we are in that. Are we on schedule for what the current Environmental Protection Agency had laid out?
Well, first of all, you have to realize that before we had this pollution reduction plan, this clean water blueprint or pollution diet, it took us 23 years to get to that point where we weren't making progress, and we put in place a series of commitments which have the force of law. So the states are obliged to meet those reduction goals with some consequences if they don't. So we're about the midpoint of that last period where we have this forced commitment. And some states, like Maryland, are on track, largely because we've done things as a state to invest in clean water, invest in advanced waste treatment facilities that have reduced pollution loads to the bay. And other states, Pennsylvania, very important for Maryland because what comes down the Susquehanna really affects the quality of the main stem of the bay in Maryland to a very large degree. They are behind schedules. And so this is where this force of law under the Clean Water Act, that's going to put some onus and some requirements on Pennsylvania to meet those objectives, is very critical. And this is why many folks are concerned about whether the Trump administration will come back and roll that back, either try to change the law or have an EPA which is not very interested in providing tough enforcement.
Is that what you, in terms of the bay cleanup, you look to the federal government for pressure on the states, or is there a role that EPA directly plays?
Yes, there's a number of things. First of all, they're kind of the watchdog on this whole effort to keep the states honest, keep the numbers, make sure we're making measurements, and we have a good system of accountability. So their role there is really critical. They also provide significant federal funding to implement these programs that comes through EPA and then it's distributed to the states. There are multiple other agencies that have to be funded to do their role. But the core of it is this new requirement under the Clean Water Act starting 7 years ago that there is a consequence if the states don't meet the reductions that they're obliged to make. There are consequences with respect to lost federal funding. They've already withheld funding from Pennsylvania. There are consequences with respect to whether the state will have the authority to govern clean water permits and so on in those states. And there are also states, so for example, if we aren't meeting it because we're not doing enough in agriculture, EPA could then require, well, you need to do even more for waste treatment. So those are the kinds of sticks, if you will, that exist in this. And if there's an administration that comes in EPA that even without any changes in the law says, we're just not going to enforce it, then, for example, why would Pennsylvania try to clean up Maryland waters of the Chesapeake Bay if they don't have this requirement under the law?
That's Donald Bosch, president of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about likely clean air and clean water policies of the Trump presidency. We heard Dean Orr, the UN climate change advisor, point to market forces as something that he saw would be continuing pressure to slow down global warming. I'm wondering whether you see similar market forces when you look at the bay cleanup.
Yes, I think there are. I mean, there's economic benefits of clean water. There isn't quite the kind of level of economic industrial engagement as there is in the new generation of energy supplies and so on, but there's definitely market forces. In fact, we're trying to harness some of those with respect to plans to make the cleanup more efficient by using trading so that if it's difficult to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus pollution from one source, maybe that source could pay another source to actually do that cleanup.
I ask because I think I'm more aware of business forces that might lobby against cleanup than for it.
Yes, indeed they are. And they are with respect to climate, with respect to the political pressure brought on by the old fossil fuel industries who are subsidized by our government, and they don't want to lose their hold on the markets. And so they're fighting against this wave towards clean energy and renewable energy. And guess what? There's huge profits. There are jobs. There's opportunities associated with that. So when you have, for example, Mr. Ebel, the presumed transition head for EPA, when he talks about not having government tell people what to do, by supporting, you know, continued expansion of fossil fuel production, coal and oil, and on public lands and without government regulation, he's actually stifling innovation and favoring old industries.
Are there other areas of environmental science that you're concerned about right now?
Well, yes, many of them, because there are other issues related to public lands, endangered species, public resources that are in other agencies other than EPA. For example, one of the areas that I worked on was oil and gas development in the Gulf of Mexico, you know, offshore oil and gas, because I was on the presidential commission. Well, we made recommendations about the problems that we saw that led to the Deepwater Horizon. And they had a lot to do with government structure and conflict of interest in the organization, lack of oversight. So the Obama administration put many of those things into place in response to our recommendations, but they were all done through executive action. There were efforts to try to put this into law through congressional action, and it never passed. So now a new president could come in, and those could go away very quickly. Those rules and safety precautions could go away pretty quickly. And you can bet that their interest in the industry, the American Petroleum Institute and others, that are eager to do that.
How do you see addressing this?
Well, I think it's a time for the public to speak out. Do you think that the American public broadly support many of the extreme positions he had to ignore climate change, to not move towards renewable energy, to not clean up the bay, to just let the private sector deal with all of that? I would say no. So I think the public, through organizations, through individual actions and so on, can help our new president-elect understand where the broader segment of public opinion is.
The editor-in-chief of Scientific American said that President-elect Trump may be the first anti-science president the United States has had. You're a scientist. Does it concern you? Do you see it that way?
Right. In fact, there's a lot of discussion now within the scientific community and concern about this. Now, Mr. Trump comes from a sophisticated urban environment. It's hard to believe that he doesn't know that much about science, but some of the things he said. So even, for example, in talking about federal funding and outcomes, he's very focused on outcomes. He even criticized the National Institutes of Health because people are still dying and getting sick. You know, they're not doing their job. Well, we need to do a better job, but who would argue against continued investment, advancing research, and the tremendous advantages and opportunities that that's provided Americans in terms of their health and well-being? I think also, you know, this is going to be about, you know, what do we use the resources we have for? And so the proper understanding investment in the long term in our scientific enterprise and understanding that it needs to be independent. It can't be politicized and just fund science that proves your point or advances what you want to do.
How optimistic are you about those arguments getting through?
Well, it's not a question of optimism. I think we have to try it. We have to do it. We have elected a president. This is all about various viewpoints and arguments in our democracy, and we need to continue to make them and hopefully prudent decisions will be made.
What is the relative risk you assign to, for example, cleaning up the bay versus the Paris Accord versus oil spills? I mean, how do you assess what the biggest risk is that you see?
I feel passionately about all of them, but pardon the pun, but climate change trumps all. We don't have time to wait. This is not something that can be put off for 4 years. To begin to dramatically reduce our emissions, time is not our friend. If we wait too long, we don't have many choices left. This was something signed by 186 nations. 145 of them have already offered up their commitments. The last one, just last week, was Australia, which is governed by a conservative government, often criticized as being in denial about climate change. Their Great Barrier Reef is dying and their country's burning. So finally, they've even made their commitment. They're all in on Paris now, at least making the commitment. So to misunderstand the breadth of support this has across the globe is a real danger for our country. It spills over not only in terms of the economic markets that are going to drive the future and that we'll be left out of them, but we'll be a pariah. We'll be a pariah in the global stage on almost everything if we stay out of this. This is that serious.
What about Maryland's own commitment to reduce greenhouse gases? Is that caught up in any of this?
Yes, it very much is, because, you know, just earlier this year, our General Assembly and Governor Hogan signed into law that commits Maryland to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 40% by 2030. That fundamentally is built on the U.S. commitment to reduce emissions by 28% by 2025 through federal action, particularly the Clean Power Plan. So if we abandon the federal effort, the Clean Power Plan, and specifically, it's very difficult, if not impossible, for us in Maryland to reach our objective.
Couldn't Maryland just rewrite its goals without attaching them to the federal goals?
Well, the goal is just that, a goal. But if you talk about realistic ways to implement them, it's hard to imagine that we'd be able to have the plan that gets there without the federal regulations taking place and the benefits of those in terms of reducing emissions from power plants that the federal government is going to execute. The federal role in energy production and in power plant regulations trumps state laws and regulations, and so we're dependent on what the federal government does.
I appreciate your giving us this perspective. I hope you'll keep in touch with us as it unfolds. Donald Bosch is president of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. Earlier, we spoke with Robert Orr, dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland College Park and special advisor to the Secretary General of the United Nations on climate change. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for being with us this morning. Hope you'll come back tomorrow.